Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida lawmakers could move to make the process of choosing new public college and university presidents secret. Not everyone likes the idea.
To be out in the open so that we can weigh in on that is something that my community takes very seriously.
Also tonight, lawmakers want to tax companies that let drivers rent out their cars like rental car agencies. But they say that's not what they are.
I would submit to you that we are just a technology platform. We own no cars.
We'll also hear about a program that helps young people with disabilities gain more financial independence. It's day two of the fifth week in the 2020 Florida lawmaking session. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to Capitol Report. The Florida legislature wants a lot less sunshine in the high-profile searches for presidents of state colleges and universities. Lawmakers are again pushing bills that would keep the names of campus presidential candidates secret until the final days before a decision is made. But there's strong opposition to this idea, and passage won't come easy, Steve Bosquet reports.
Picking presidents at Florida colleges and universities can be controversial, as it was 6 years ago, when Florida State chose John Thrasher, a high-profile political leader, former lobbyist, and staunch FSU supporter who had no academic pedigree or background in classroom teaching. But the search was out in the open, in compliance with Florida's Sunshine Law, as it's supposed to be. Students and faculty protested, but it played out in public, and the consensus is that Thrasher has exceeded expectations. Some lawmakers still say all that public attention discourages strong candidates from applying. The sponsor of a House bill to make searches secret is Representative Chris Latvala of Clearwater.
I think the goal of this bill is, you know, to get the best possible people to apply for these positions and not have to worry about their names being released and, you know, worrying about their current positions.
The bill would keep secret the names of all candidates until 3 weeks before a final vote, when a list of finalists would be public. At a hearing in the House State Affairs Committee, numerous critics told legislators that transparency is needed to build public trust and that secrecy stokes suspicion and mistrust. Marshall Ogletree is with United Faculty of Florida.
I've seen this bill now for the last 6 years. It's a bad idea then, it's a bad idea now. We have the best university and college system in America. I think most of you recognize that. That's an important thing. So what's wrong with the leadership we have? What's wrong with President Thrasher? What's wrong with President Correll at USF?
Others argue that because a university is a major economic and political force in its community, selecting its leader is everyone's business. James Engel of Gainesville is a union electrician.
Gainesville is kind of a company town, and that company's UF. You're talking about the head of the largest employers in our area, people that are over a quarter of our population is students there. For that to be out in the open so that we can weigh in on that is something that my community takes very seriously. When there's a new president coming to UF or to Santa Fe, it's big news. It's something everybody's involved in, and to take that away from us, I think, would be very damaging for our community.
Despite that argument and many others, the House committee passed the secrecy bill on a 16-6 vote. All but one of the yes votes were cast by Republicans, and all six no votes were cast by Democrats. Arguing for the bill was Republican Representative Cindy Stevenson of St. John's.
I believe it does have a chilling effect. The public process does have a chilling effect in the kind of applicants we get, and some of the in other areas as well. And balancing that with the public interest is a hard thing, and I think you've tried to do this in this bill.
The secrecy bill is advancing at a time when two of the state's largest institutions, Miami-Dade College and the University of Central Florida, are in the midst of searches for new presidents. And because the proposal is a new public records exemption, passage requires a two-thirds vote in both the House and Senate. I'm Steve Bosquet.
As we just heard from Steve Bosquet, a persistent desire by some in the Florida legislature to shield public college and university presidential searches from public scrutiny is back for, what, the umpteenth time? The arguments remain the same. Supporters say the state's open records laws keep good people away because they don't want employers to know that they're job hunting. Opponents argue sunshine is the best disinfectant and fear closing such high-profile jobs from public access will create an environment of cronyism. Is either true? Lynn Hatter spoke with Zach Smith of the executive search firm Witt Kiefer to get an idea on what happens behind the scenes. The firm has worked in both open and confidential states.
Have you ever worked in a completely open environment? Have you ever worked in a completely closed environment? And what are your observations with how these kind of systems work?
It's a great question. I've worked in both.
What are some of the differences that you've noted working in both of these systems? Any benefits, any drawbacks to both?
You know what? There are pros and cons to both, I would say. I think the benefit of a confidential search is that you provide a level of security for the candidates who would like to enter the pool, who may be at risk of losing their jobs back at their own institutions. And that's a very real issue that happens. I would say that you will have a stronger pool if it's a confidential process, because you'll have more candidates be comfortable entering the pool and entering the search. By that very fact alone, you're going to have a stronger and deeper candidate pool.
But are there offsets to that? Does size of institution matter, quality of institution, quality of reputation? Are those the kind of things that could offset some of those concerns, or does the confidentiality aspect kind of override everything?
So you're saying because of the institution's reputation, so let's say the University of Florida, for
example.
Yes,
exactly.
Because if they go out to market because of their reputation, you're saying, does it really matter if it's open, public or confidential, because Florida's going to attract great candidates regardless.
Exactly. And that's that. Yeah. Yeah. Because that's something that's kind of come up in this debate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, reputation of institution would help a search regardless if it's confidential or public. But that still does not take away from the fact that there will be some candidates who will not enter the pool, and in some ways, at a high quality institution that has the ability to attract very high quality candidates. So, for example, sitting president of another institution, those are the candidates where you're not going to see an eagerness for those folks to apply. They will just not opt in because they would rather enter a search process of another high-quality institution that is keeping it confidential.
One of the concerns that I've heard is if we close this presidential search, it will lead to basically what amounts to institutional cronyism.
Can I respond to that?
Yes,
is, I think, what you're getting at, which is something I find interesting, because hasn't that happened in Florida already, right? Yeah, and so that I read that somewhere, you know, and I can't remember where I read that, but I found that interesting because that's happened quite a lot in Florida. So I guess I would actually argue the opposite, that because you're going to be able to attract stronger candidates in the pool, because you're going to be able to attract, you know, a lot of really fine sitting presidents at, like you said, at some of your excellent institutions that you have in Florida. My actual feeling about that is that you may have less of that phenomenon happening because you're going to have candidates that are going to be really hard to ignore that are in the pool. And if it does happen, my sense is that would have happened whether or not it was public or private, because it's already happening and it's public. So that's kind of an interesting, it was an interesting argument, because I found that actually I thought it would be quite the opposite.
That was Capitol reporter Len Hatter speaking with Zach Smith of the search firm Witt Kiefer on the pros and cons of confidential versus open public university searches. Floridians would get sales tax breaks before hurricane season and the new school year, while taxes on commercial leases, cell phones, and other communication services would be trimmed, all that under a tax package rolled out today in the House. The $100 million proposal is a starting point as the House and Senate prepare to negotiate a budget in the course of the next month. It also calls for increasing a refund on aviation fuel taxes, doing away with an unused pool of money for professional sports stadiums, and expanding a tax distribution requirement about charter schools. Advocates say the goal is to address as many areas as possible with the money available. The largest part of the package is a proposed 3-day back-to-school tax holiday in August, which would allow shoppers to avoid paying sales taxes on most clothes, school supplies, and personal computers. The proposal is projected to save shoppers about $41.8 million. A disaster relief tax holiday at the end of May would allow people to avoid sales taxes when buying items ranging from battery packages to portable generators. Voters would be asked in November to give people more time to transfer homestead exemptions to new homes under a plan approved today by the House Ways and Means Committee. The legislation would extend from 2 calendar years to 3 calendar years the time for Floridians to transfer their Save Our Homes benefit, which caps increases on taxable assessments on homesteaded property at 3% a year. Sponsor Rick Roth says the so-called portability of Save Our Homes was designed to give property owners up to 2 years to complete the transfer paperwork, but the current law sets the timeline based on the calendar year, which could be as little as 1 year and 1 day. The State Revenue Estimating Conference has estimated the proposed change would trim local property taxes by nearly $2 million next fiscal year. If approved by 60% of voters in November, the law would take effect January 1st. Still to come on Capitol Report, the very idea of human corneas as a profit-driven commodity causes consternation at the Capitol.
I had never considered organ donations as something that you can make a profit off of. In fact, I thought that was illegal.
And the state of Florida is promoting its savings plan for people with disabilities.
Ask friends and family to contribute to the account online rather than give those things that are just going to pile up in the closet.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by Cloud Navigator, providing cloud computing services and creating secure and productive workplaces for businesses and government agencies. Cloud Navigator, a Microsoft Cloud Platform partner operating throughout the Southeast. On the web at cloudnav.com.
Florida lawmakers want to tax companies that let drivers rent out their cars. A proposal in the legislature would apply the same surcharge regular rental car companies pay to transactions made through apps like Turo. But Blaise Ganey reports the same companies say they aren't rental car agencies and should not be treated as such.
As new inventions and jobs are created, new laws on what can be done with them usually follow. With rideshare services like Uber, it took time, but Florida passed legislation regulating it. Now lawmakers are focusing on a new rideshare service. This one lets users shop around for a car to rent from private owners who've put their car on the app. Pinellas Republican Representative Chris Latvala believes the users renting cars should have to pay the same fees they would if they were to rent from a place like Enterprise.
The bill makes it clear that the rental car surcharge and sales tax, which is levied on every renter of a vehicle in Florida, includes rentals by peer-to-peer car sharing companies.
That sales tax was passed decades ago, mainly to make sure every car on Florida's roads got taxed. Rental car companies get a tax break when they buy their fleet of cars in bulk, so Florida created a surcharge. Leslie Dougie with Enterprise National in Alamo Car Rental explains.
In 1987, the state of Florida approved the rental car surcharge, and they decided that people who were putting wheels on the road, tourists, businesses, and Floridians by renting cars, should help pay for maintenance and paying for building the roads.
The surcharge is $2 per day. Dougie thinks customers are at a disadvantage when renting with traditional companies because they are required to pay the fee, while there's no fee for peer-to-peer sharing companies. Dougie says the apps should be treated just like rental car agencies. She says it's not just an agreement between friends.
Contractual agreement is between the owner of the vehicle and the peer-to-peer company. Additionally, the contractual agreement is between the person who rents a car and wants to rent a car from that site and the site. So there's no real peer-to-peer.
Avail, owned by Allstate, is one of the peer-to-peer companies. George Feju represents the company. He says it is not a rental car agency.
I would submit to you that we are just a technology platform. We own no cars. We own zero cars. So at the end of the day, what we're doing here is we're recreating a system and trying to make it more efficient and consumer friendly and safe and insured of a possible transaction that can happen today between you and your neighbor.
Feju says taxing his customers isn't fair because the car owners already paid a tax when they purchased the car.
The rental car surcharge, when it was developed and put into law, did not contemplate the inputs that are going into our business model, right, such as the sales tax that's already being paid in. So that's why I think what we're submitting is that it will just inflate the cost on our side of the business model.
Latvala says he's hoping to work with people on both sides of the issue as the bill moves forward. I'm Blaze Gainey.
Florida lawmakers want to ban for-profit eye banks. Eye banks retrieve, store, and help deliver corneas to people who need them. The industry has been dominated by nonprofit groups, but Robbie Gaffney reports that trend is changing.
When someone looks into a mirror, they may not notice their cornea. It's as thick as a dime and clear, like the glass covering on a watch. Eye infections can damage corneas and cause people to go blind. To see again, most patients will need a corneal transplant. According to the Eye Bank Association of America, more than 85,000 people got corneal transplants in 2018. The procedures are coordinated by eye banks, and until recently, the majority of these banks were nonprofit. But in 2016, the for-profit CorneaGen opened, and St. Petersburg Senator Daryl Roussan is taking issue with its Florida branch. He worries a for-profit company might make people think twice before donating.
If people, donors that is, feel as though someone's going to make money off their donation, it could be a chilling factor on donations.
Samantha Haynes is waiting in line at the DMV. She's a registered organ donor and surprised to hear about for-profit banks.
I had never considered organ donations as something that you could make a profit off of. In fact, I thought that was illegal.
Right now, it is illegal to buy or sell organs in the United States. But nonprofit and for-profit companies can charge fees for behind-the-scenes work. Everything from transporting organs to blood testing can be billed to physicians who in turn charge patients for that cost. Roussan is concerned for-profit banks will use extra money from fees to line people's pockets. Haynes says even if that's true, she would still choose to be a donor.
Well, the for-profits, it's still going for a good cause. I would still probably say that I'd like to remain a donor just on the off chance that somebody who's in dire need of an organ in an unfortunate circumstance on my end would get what they need.
Patricia Ford is also at the DMV. When asked if for-profit banks would affect Ford's decision to register as an organ donor, she said,
yes.
Ford also says she doesn't agree with the concept of charging patients for donated tissue, whether it be from a nonprofit or for-profit bank.
My Southern background says that if I give someone something, there should be no charge in it. It should be unconditional. So the transportation, whoever the giver, because I've donated it, so they're no longer mine. I'm not here, so I could care less. But that group or entity that is making the decision to give it to someone else who it may help save their sight or whatever the case may be, it's not fair to them to charge them for a gift that I left them.
CorneaGen CEO Monty Montoya says his company's for-profit status has disrupted the industry. He says the extra money coming in goes toward research. His company's goal is to eliminate corneal blindness by 2040. One of the technologies it's developing to do that involves growing cells from a donor's cornea, adding a substance to it, and then injecting those cells into a patient's eye.
One cornea provides one person a chance to see again. Well, with this, we would expand it so that hundreds and maybe even thousands of patients would have a chance to see from one cornea.
Nonprofit banks like Lion's Eye Institute for Transplant and Research also conduct research. The company CEO, Jason Woody, says Lion's Eye uses donated eyes to study diseases.
One, it could be a whole eye, which could be used for, you know, for research studies such as glaucoma, age-related macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, for multiple diseases which most, you know, people have, know someone in their family or are themselves are impacted.
According to Woody, hospitals can choose which eye banks to partner with, whether that's for or nonprofit. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
Gina Jordan has a preview of tomorrow's Capitol action.
Here's a look at some of tomorrow's happenings in the Florida legislature. The Senate will hold a floor session. Members will consider the chamber's proposed $92.8 billion budget for the next fiscal year. Priorities include providing money for teacher salary increases and environmental projects. The House will hold an afternoon floor session where members will take up that chamber's more conservative $91.3 billion budget proposal. A bill would create the First Responders Suicide Deterrence Task Force. The task force would develop training programs and materials to help first responders cope with issues such as work-related stress. Cities and counties may soon be able to regulate smoking in public parks they own. Law enforcement may soon have to get a warrant to conduct real-time location tracking or acquire historical location data from a cell phone or other electronic device. The Florida League of Mayors will hold a news conference to discuss legislative issues such as water quality and short-term vacation rentals. And finally, female lawmakers will take part in an event called Keep Roaring On, 1920 to 2020, to mark the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in the United States. They'll also participate in a news conference calling for Florida to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. That's some of what's happening tomorrow at the Capitol. I'm Gina Jordan.
In a case that could have a significant impact on the 2020 elections and future partisan races, a federal appeals court is scheduled tomorrow to hear arguments in a challenge to a decades-old Florida law requiring candidates who are in the same party as the governor to appear first on the ballot. The Democratic National Committee, other national Democratic organizations, and the Priorities USA Super PAC filed the federal lawsuit back in 2018. In November, U.S. District Judge Mark Walker found the state law unconstitutional because it imposes a discriminatory burden on plaintiffs' voting rights. A House investigative committee late Monday delved further into the issue of Chinese meddling at Florida research institutions, that following a recent case at Moffitt Cancer Center. The Tampa Cancer Center, which receives state funding, went through a shakeup after the center's chief executive officer, a senior member of the center, and four researchers resigned over alleged violations of conflict of interest rules related to work in China. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Elizabeth Ricci runs an immigration law practice in Tallahassee along with her husband, Neil Rambana. Their older daughter, Paloma, who's now in high school, has a rare visual impairment. Ricci says Paloma will need more financial resources to live a more normal life.
My daughter's probably not going to be able to drive. She's going to need, I don't know about a driver, but lots of Ubers and things like that. Books, assistive technology, healthcare. And if you can start now when they're young, just like so many families do with Florida prepaid college, it's a way to save for their future. So whether my husband and I are around in the future or not, it's something there for her that she can use to have a better life in the future as an adult, an independent adult.
The something to which Ricci refers is Florida's ABLE United Savings Program. Similar to the Florida Prepaid College Savings Plan, Ricci explains the program used to have some pretty strict income and contribution limits, but not anymore.
Limitations generally were this $2,000 that people who had disabilities and were receiving benefits could have in assets. So with an ABLE account, you can save way more than that. You can save up to $15,000 a year, and you don't have the limitation of interference with means-tested benefits. You are not in conflict with Social Security or Medicaid benefits, for example, and it's tax-free, and it's FDIC insured. So it's a pretty flexible savings instrument.
Because of her daughter's circumstances, Ricci has been named an ABLE United Program Ambassador to spread the word.
We want people to know that they can open these accounts for their family members who have a disability, a qualifying disability, as long as they were diagnosed before the age of 26 and live in Florida. It's a great way to allow those people to invest and save for their futures for things that they need.
Ricci says a simple Google search for Florida ABLE United will bring up all the information an interested person might want, including what disabilities qualify.
Disabilities like autism or blindness, deafness, cerebral palsy, things like that qualify. But if you're not sure, you can go on there and see if the disability does qualify. You can set up the account. And this month, with as little as $25, ABLE will contribute $50 to get you started, to encourage you to start that account. And then you can start telling friends and family, hey, you can contribute to this instead of a birthday gift or a holiday gift. Here's how you can do that. And that money will go much further for quality of life rather than, you know, something that's going to be forgotten after being played with for a little bit.
And in full disclosure, Ricci's law firm is one of the underwriters of Capital Report. Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Gainey, Robbie Gaffney, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Steve Bosquet. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us every weeknight at this time throughout the 2020 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capital Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Rambana and Ricci, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ricci, on the web at rambana.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flafl-cio.org.